Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. February 12th, 2017, episode 103. Let me count the ways. Hello, one and all, and welcome to our third installment for 2017. February is rolling along, and don't ask me where January went. Life has been a blur these recent weeks as I've been working some crazy hours at BMS, but I've been on my game about spending any spare moments I have prepping the podcast. Recently, it's been a spate of 12-plus hour days with blemished weekends, given work has been spilling over into Saturday and Sundays. But there's a funny side effect to that. People always ask me, where do I find the time? And I started contemplating that recently. I come home at night, leaving in the dark most mornings and coming home in the dark most nights, exhausted. Most nights I grab a bite to eat, do some necessary chores, and crash on the couch or chair until someone wakes me to go to bed. I've been going to bed no later than 9 or 10 p.m. on most nights, and when I do, I'm up at 3 or 4 in the morning, lying in bed, wide awake, staring at the ceiling because I really only need 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night. What do I do? Some nights I get up and shower and go to work to get caught up. Other times I come downstairs and prepare podcast notes. So, in a roundabout way, I've been terribly busy but pretty productive for the podcast. How interesting is that for the dynamic? As I record this, it's 4:07 a.m. Saturday, the day before the podcast release. I've been up for about 30 minutes now, and at some point here, during the recording, I think I'll sneak up and make myself a cup of coffee. I woke up at 3:30 a.m. this morning after tossing and turning a little. What was on my mind is that Dave asked me yesterday if I could help set up the sound for today's NJBA state meeting. They ordered equipment, but the organizer wasn't familiar with it, for the sound system and speakers, and asked me if I would step in to help because I try to do that wherever I can. While I'm familiar with our sound system for Northwest, this one is sight unseen. So I was thinking in bed that I best prep our NWNJBA sound system, which I'm familiar with, and bring it along as a backup. And that requires charging the batteries and all the things that go along with that. This is a fundamental concept of a statewide meeting. If there is no sound, there is no meeting. And I don't particularly want to be the one under duress in those circumstances. So I was running through all the contingencies in my mind. Once I started in on that concern, I'm awake. And, you know, I ran through all the options and decided what I was going to do. And now satisfied, debated whether I should just get up or try and sleep a little bit longer. But my mind, meandering through topics, go through prep for the meeting. It's too early. You have time. But you're going to be away all weekend. Oh, how is the podcast going to get finished for Sunday? You see, the schedule for today is all day through and a banquet tonight and all day through tomorrow. It's a two-day deal. Yeah, Kevin, since you can't sleep, why not go downstairs and record the podcast? You know, by the way, spring is coming. Am I ready for that? Yeah, the mind's a terrible thing. In the middle of my night sojourn, the notion of how fast spring is coming is coming. I get excited and anxious at this time of year. This week we saw the snowdrops pushing through one day while on our walk, and then I had our first snowfall that amounted to anything the day after that. Warm days have been interspersed with days where I'm wearing long underwear to work. I don't know what it is about my building. Where I sit against a window, and it's just cold in my section of the building, so I've had to bundle up. Yes, I'm simply ready for spring in my mind, but yet I'm not really ready in the prepared sense. You see, spring is a golden opportunity, and I want to squeeze every ounce of goodness out of it for beekeeping. And to do that, well, a mind like mine says you need to be prepared. So many wonderful beekeeping things to do, and like I said, I'm getting excited. All right, enough of that. Got a podcast to run around here. Sometimes a little taste of how the sausage gets made around here gives the catalog some memories for me when I go back and listen to it. And now you have some inside baseball on how, in some fringe ways, the show gets produced. Actually, it's almost never like this. There's probably a handful of episodes that have had middle-of-the-night recordings like this. I typically record straight up on a Friday night or Saturday night, most days during humming hours. But every once in a while, you got to do what you got to do. So much to cover, so little precious time, and I want to get to the first topic, but still I'm going to invest some of our hour together to let you know what's coming up. Can bees count? Meaning 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. We'll explore the notion. A description of a 2x4 wooden hive stand. Where to see live bees on the web. A promotional offer for custom seed packet sample. Honey, mustard, chickpeas. Where to check out a video of a cut comb frame. I'll explain what that is. Listener feedback. And to finish up the episode, a short recap of the Philly Beekeeping Symposium. But first, a local hive report. Here we go. For the local hive report, there's not really much to say. On the opening, you heard me say I've been working some crazy hours, somewhat 7 days a week. I had a lot of thoughts that I would be making a couple tweaks and adjustments, but fact of the matter is they're out there fending for themselves. I'm a little bit nervous about my nucleus colonies and the one colony over the farm, but so far I think things are okay. I was hoping things would stay a little bit warmer, but actually over the last week or so it's been a little bit cooler here in New Jersey and downright cold on some nights. We have so little to go to get to spring, yet these days make me nervous. So for the local hive report, there's really not much to say. I haven't been in my hive, so they're in the same condition. I don't think I'm going to get into them till next week, if not later than that. So we'll see. Hopefully they're on their own and they're muddling along. I did leave them with plenty of food and stores, although I'm a little bit concerned, as I've been saying, about the yellow jacket onslaught towards the end of the year and whether that impacted either populations or food sources. But at this point, given that snowdrops are pushing through and we're starting to see some of the daffodils push through, spring has got to be coming really soon, and skunk cabbage and some of the early plants will be up. And if we can get to that week, which might even be next week or the week after, I think bees are going to make it through. So keep your fingers crossed, everybody, and hope for spring to get here pretty quickly. That's it. Not really much to the local hive report, but expect business to be picking up as we get a little closer into March and certainly into April. Segment number one is entitled, Can Bees Count? As humans, maybe we take for granted that we've devised a numbering system, and of course, math is math, so we can count, perform simple, and of course, complex equations. On the counting front, one has to have an awareness of numbers in order to assign a value to an abstract object, real or imagined, then sum up the values as none, one, or more than one. animals and insects do amazing things that at their core seem to suggest that counting inherently has to be part of the behavior patterns. Little else could explain how they could evolve to do such things. But animal and insects don't know numbers, do they? Well, there's been a long-standing scientific debate about the very topic, and while animals and insects probably don't hold the same concept of 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, they do seem to have an innate ability to count. The cognition of non-human abilities has long been studied, and there are amazing examples in nature of cognitive abilities for animals and insects. And I want to talk about one such study for honeybees. We have all learned that honeybees report to the colony a location of a food source through behavior, but there's some math in that translation. The waggle dance is an amazing aspect in its own right, as it mixes distance, direction, and math in the form of the number of rotations to convey an idea. There are other subtle nuances of the waggle dance that I didn't add, such as emphasis of the dance, but let's just focus on the math part. So counting in the aspect of the dance occurs on several fronts. How many turns? How many waggles? And one might suggest even how many steps the bee takes in the waggle dance could be counted if the bees do indeed count. The parallel aspect of the waggle dance, which has a math aspect to it, is measurement, or more so distance. How far did the bee go until it turned? How wide was the tail of the bee swept side to side? As humans, we may not be able to discern what aspect of math is being visually assessed by the bees, but we know that it translates into a behavior to the bee. Go that direction for this far and you'll find something. So what I just described is our understanding of what all that dance means, but there's more to the story that we kind of know of too. When bees go outside for the first time, they orient to the landscape. This is in their innate ability to grasp their surroundings and build a visual map to return home. They also use visual clues to remember where foraging is. I'm going to ask you to hold on to that notion for a second, as it will become important in our discussion about whether insects, and in this case honeybees, can count. So, human perspective now. It would not be uncommon for a human to say, "Go down Main Street, take a left at the third light." As we drive down Main Street, we're making a mental note. 1, 2, there's the third light, put your blinker on. Do honeybees do that? Fly down the dirt lane below and to the third oak and make a left. 1 oak, 2 oak, third oak, bank left. It turns out the answer is probably maybe. In a 1994 study, there was a probe to this very question. I'd be the first one to admit that I might say that this experiment seems contrived, and you could ask whether it would ever translate in nature, but let's review it, and you could be the judge when I'm done. Get yourself a frosty beverage or whatever it takes, because it's going to take a little while. I'm going to take you through a pretty interesting journey here. So here's the setup. This discussion is going to reference a study conducted by Lars Chitka and Carl Geiger from the Institute for Neurobiology in Berlin, Germany, 1994. The study entitled, "Can Honeybees Count Landmarks?" will be linked to in our show notes if you want to read it for yourself. In the study, they set up 4 identical landmarks in the landscape in the form of tents. They were spaced 300 meters apart, and they had a feeder placed between the third and fourth tent, or they refer to them interchangeably as landmarks. The test consisted of altering combinations of the number of tents to the food source and the distances in which the tents or landmarks were set up. In the experiment's description, it states that the tests were conducted in a large, level meadow, practically devoid of natural orientation cues, near Brandenburg, Germany. A honeybee hive was set up in the center of the meadow, and workers were trained to collect the sugar solution at a feeder 262.5 meters from the hive. They established a pattern of at least 20 to 30 bees were continuously flying back and forth between the hive and the feeder. Along the flight path, they set up four yellow tents of tetrahedral shape. They were set at 75, 150, 225, and 300 meters, respectively, and the feeding site was set halfway between the third and fourth tent, or in the study concept, as I said, landmarks. An interesting point about the distances takes into account the spectrum at which the bee can take in the landscape and judge other landmarks. The distances were set so that the bee could only see one landmark from the one that they were closest to, but not the others, so as to skew their ability to string together a pattern of landmarks from here to there. Taking into account a bee's visual acuity, the bee could only detect the next or previous landmark, but could not discern or learn information about the spatial relationships to the other landmarks. My interpretation of this is they were trying to eliminate any possibility that the bees were building data on distance, which would make the assessment of counting cloudy by introducing another element that could influence behaviors. So now that we have the setup, let me tell you what the game plan was. As I stated, they set the feeder between the third and fourth tent, and they did a control to teach the bees where the feeder was. Then they adjusted the number of tents in between the food source and the feeder by adding additional tents into the mix. The question is, will the bees stop between the third and fourth tent, or will they fly over more tents to get to the distance where the feeder was, according to what they knew by experience? So let me make sure I didn't lose anyone back there. Recall that there were four tents set at a predetermined distance with a feeder between three and four. They added another tent into the mix. Now they have five. They spaced the five tents along the same overall distance and left the original feeder in the same distance, location-wise. So now there's a feeder in the gap between tents four and five. In addition, hold on to this, they placed another feeder between tents 3 and 4, and when I go through the experiment, you'll understand why. You have to think of it this way. If bees go strictly on distance, then you would expect that they would care less about the landmark tents and fly to the 262.5 meter point and the original feeder to get something to eat. But if they were counting landmarks, you would think that they would count 1, 2, 3. Yes, I found a feeder before tent number 4 and swoop in and get something to eat. Let me take a sidebar here for a second and say there were some additional details about how they released the bees, how they managed the bees so that they would not report back to the rest of the colony and such. But for brevity point, I'm not going to go into that. It's not that that is not unimportant. It's simply too much detail for me to cover. What I will tell you is that it appears that they took a lot of care to discern how they should manage the bees leaving and counting the bees landing to ensure the way the experiment was conducted would stand up to scrutiny. I'll go as far as sharing that, again, they controlled the release of the bees and the ability for the bees to report back as part of the management of visitors. In other words, they didn't want to tell the colony and skew their thing. Everybody leaving from the colony was leaving on their own accord and finding whatever they found without any influence from other bees. Hopefully that's clear. All right, let's talk about what happened. And what I'll do is take you through the various things that they did and then tell you the outcomes as we go along. So results reported. So here's what they reported as an outcome when they increased the number of tents from 4 to 5. The majority of bees still landed at the position closest to the original feeder location. The tally was 74% of them. That means with now 5 tents in the mix, they flew over the in-between gap of 3 and 4 to the gap where the original feeder sat now between 4 and 5. However, if you think of it the other way, 26% of the bees, over one quarter of them, did stop after tent number 3, and it was considered a significant difference from the control, so they were going to continue the experiment. After they gathered those results, they altered the experiment one more time to put 6 tents in the mix, same distance. Now note that they had the original feeder near the control position at around 270 meters, but with 6 tents, now between the landmarks of 5 and 6, they had a feeder. That's where 270 meters was. So again, reiterating that they wanted to see if the bees were counting, they put a feeder between 3 and 4 in order to see if the bees would go to that landmark 1, landmark 2, landmark 3, feeder. And as an interesting twist, you would consider that they just ran an experiment where they had 5 landmarks, and there was a feeder in between landmarks 3 and 4 and 4 and 5. So for good measure, it looks like they put a feeder between landmarks 4 and 5. Yeah, confused? Hold on. I'll clean that up. In the 6 landmark feeder study, there are now 3 feeder sites. One between 3 and 4, one between 4 and 5, and a third one that is between 5 and 6. 3 and 4 is for counting. 1, 2, 3, feeder just before 4. 4 and 5 is because bees just learned that there was a feeder there in the last setup. And 5 and 6 is right near the original distance so that they could determine if bees are strictly going to it because they learned from the original distance in the control study. Got it? Okay, so how did this 6 landmark test turn out? The majority of the bees landed at the 2nd feeder, the one between 4 and 5. 58% of the bees landed there. In 2nd of the 3 feeder locations was the original distance feeder, the one between 5 and 6 with 33%. And the remainder of them went to the landmark after tent number 3. So it appears in the 6 landmark experiment, most of the bees chose the compromise between 1, 2, 3 feeder and flying the distance they knew to have a feeder from the original control setup in the training situation. I would guess that if I were a researcher, this result would lead to more questions. Perhaps the same thing happened here. As they left the feeders on the ground and reset the landmarks, the original control positions of 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and left the 3 feeders in the 6 landmark study in place and released the bees to see what would happen. By a large majority, they flew to the feeder between 3 and 4. 75% of the bees went to the farthest feeder at the original 270-meter location. The other two were split fairly closely with the remaining 25%. What to make of all this? I'm guessing that if you were like me, you're thinking at this point, this is just a little too haphazard to draw any conclusions as to whether or not they're counting. So bear with me as they did one more test that turned up an interesting result and gets us closer to an answer. One final experiment was conducted where they changed the length of the field of play and spread the landmarks out. So in this experiment, it's important to remember that the magical feeder was around 270 meters. And recall, between landmarks 3 and 4 in the control. In the case of the final tests, they extended the field to 450 meters and spaced 4 landmarks. This is the same experiment as the control, but the landmarks are spaced further apart. That means the original feeder at the original control distance of 262 meters was now between landmarks 2 and 3, and to test counting, they put another between 3 and 4, but now 3 and 4 is 337 meters, so there would be one at that magical gap between the landmarks 3 and 4. Kevin, moment. Hold on a second. If you're astute, you'll note something in these recounts. I don't know why, but in some of these tests, the feeder was at the control position of 262.5 meters, and in others, it was at 270 meters, a distance of 8 meters or thereabouts. Why did they do that? I can only speculate that they were trying to be true to having the feeder location at the halfway point between the landmarks. To do that with the various landmark configurations, they had to adjust the sweet spot for the feeder. I suppose 8 meters might not have been a big deal, but it was a bit of a nit of mine that I could not ignore without acknowledging and saying out loud for you. Because I'm flipping back and forth between 262 and 270, and it might be driving somebody crazy. Okay, back to our regularly scheduled program. End of Kevin moment. With four landmarks and a longer distance, they were either going to leave the hive and go to that 260, 270-ish meters, or go 1, 2, 3. I'm in the gap between 3 and 4. There should be a feeder if they are indeed counting. The result? 78% of the bees flew the distance of the 260, 270 meters. 22% of them went 2, 3. There's the feeder between 3 and 4. Okay, one last experiment, and then we'll get to conclusions. They took one more shot at the longer distance with another tweak. With the field still at 450, 500 meters, they spaced out 5/10. This placed the control feeder location between landmarks 3 and 4, and a feeder was placed at 4 and 5. In this experiment, the bees flew both to the advertised distance and the magical gap between 3 and 4. An overwhelming amount of them landed between 3 and 4, which was at the 262-foot distance, but it can be noted that a small handful of bees did continue on to the second feeder between 4 and 5. So really, what did we learn? There was an undertone in the research results that suggested that bees factor in an energy investment when they are seeking food. It might be said that this is one of the more interesting things gleaned from the study for me, but it was a known thing stipulated going into the study. In this opening, it indicated that bees have to consider energy investment for flying when trying to figure out how far they've flown. They don't have a tape measure, so to speak, right? This, in conjunction with taking how hard the wind is blowing and from what direction, is how they judge distance. How much energy, how hard the wind is blowing, and from what direction. And also some cues from the sun and landmarks. The conclusion of the research led the researchers to believe that the bees are relying more on this internal measure of distance, factors of energy investment, passing of time, perhaps some other external cues, more heavily than the landmarks they placed out in the field. It became apparent to me when studying the result diagrams in the actual study that each one seemed to show a spike at the 262-270 distance, no matter how long the field was or how many tents. And I think they're saying the same thing in their conclusion. However, there did appear to be some signs that the altering of the landmarks did sway some bees to behave differently. I think it's evident in some ways by the way the bees flew past a feeder to another feeder, and the study conclusion hypothesized that the bees may have employed a strategy where they learned to land after a landmark the third tent, but possibly have chosen some kind of compromise that matches the situation they had memorized, meaning they're using a landmark to say it's around here somewhere and something, well, you know, maybe it's before the landmark, or some say maybe it's after, but they didn't really count. They just said, I've encountered the landmark, let me look forward or backwards. They flew the general distance based on other factors and then used the bias to look forward or backward to look for a feeder. As the conclusion rolled on in this paper, statements went into an evaluation of this approach versus ones that had come before this study and made an assessment of how to decide if bees were counting and what approach had merit. It talked about the science that came before and the differing opinions on how counting was being assessed, and it seems to me it could not declare a victory. So here's a little something for you to know. Sometimes when you read these papers, you realize that the researchers were working it out back in 1994. The giveaway is the title and its lack of assertion that a bee can or cannot count. It says, in quotes, my quotes, can honeybees count landmarks? Question mark. When they put a question mark, they're making a non-declarative statement. So by way of what we covered here, it didn't say we have proven that they could count landmarks or something like that in the study. I think there were a few interesting anomalies that could lead you to believe they reacted differently to the different setups. But in the end, I am not personally convinced that they counted. Based on what I saw, and by what I see in the conclusion, the researchers seemed to shy away from declaring that too. If this were the show Mythbusters, I think right about now we'd be seeing the spinning debunked thing. Now, mind you, this was 1994, and a lot of things have changed since then, so maybe they got better on the science. And one of these days I'll come across something that talks about whether bees can or cannot count. As always, there'll be a link in the show notes, Can Honeybees Count Landmarks? Only one segment prepared for this episode, but a whole slew of roundtables. Roundtable number one, 2x4 hive stand. Sometimes while I'm watching TV, I poke around on Pinterest. And of course, I look for beekeeping things here and there. In my travels, I found a photo, but no supporting evidence for the plans for a hive stand made of 2x4 lumber. The design seems simple and low cost and bears sharing. Wait, you might say, didn't you tell us in the past of a hive stand you made from PVC? Yes, of course, I used PVC hive stands for all of my hives on a design that I made, but it doesn't mean I can't appreciate another design. And, well, I simply like the simplicity of these. So I'm going to tell you about them. If you want to see my PVC one, go to our homepage. There's plans for it there. So 2x4, let me see if I can verbally describe what I see in the image. First, you take three pieces of 2x4s, cut to length, and I don't know the length, and you create one end of the stand. So it's simply two uprights and a center rail that make the wood into an H shape. It's not all flat against flat. When you're looking at the front of the H uprights, they have the 2-inch side facing you for the up and down, but the horizontal has the flat side facing you. I hope that description makes sense. And of course, since it's a hive stand and has two sides, you have to make two of these H's. Now you have two H's. You need to have a support beam to hold the hive and connect the two sets of legs together. Two more 2x4s do the trick here. They bridge alongside the upright and sit on the top of the horizontal. The end of the board matches up flat to flat with the uprights on the one H and the other H sitting behind it. When connecting both H's, they form the base for the hive to rest on and the bridge, and they bridge the distance underneath the hive between the two H's. Yeah, hold on a minute. This sounds like an epic fail in description. If you got that, I don't know how, because even I'm confused. I can't mentally conjure up what this looks like after listening to myself describe it to you. So if you found it hard to imagine, fear not. I'll post an image in the show notes for this roundtable so you could see what I described. And if you make one of these, let me know. I think I might just make one just because. Like I said, I like the picture. Moving on. Roundtable number two, live bees on the web. Sometimes you need to see live bees on the web. Get something to write with, or open a browser if you're able, and I'm going to give you a URL in a minute. If you're out and about, no worries. I'll have a link in the show notes. It's kind of cool to think that you could be part of a world in another place, and at some point you'll be able to do it on demand with virtual reality. Imagine standing in Times Square doing a 360-degree look at what's going on, but from your own home, like the holodeck on Star Trek. That will come for someday, but for now, live cams of things will have to do, and I have a link for you to sneak away to. To promote beekeeping, the New Jersey Department of Agriculture has a live bee cam on their site. State of New Jersey, right? Who knew? Now, cool. Visit nj.gov/agriculture/divisions/PI. That's P as in Paul, I as in India, /PROG/bcam.html. Let me do that one more time. nj.gov/agriculture/divisions/PI/PROG/bcam.html. There you'll see a live shot of their observation hive from the Department of Agriculture's Philip Belampi Beneficial Insect Laboratory in West Trenton, New Jersey. If you didn't get that URL, just visit our show notes, show 103. Roundtable number three, custom seed packets, Bentley Seeds. Charlie Ilsley shared a promotional link with me recently for free custom seed packets from the Bentley Seed Company. There's a website which I'll give you a link to in a second, or again, you can look in the show notes where you can obtain the link. Our Beekeepers Association has been looking for a place to source seed packets to give away at public outreach events. And we'll have to give this company a look. In looking around at their site, there's a custom seed packet page where you could see the prices for a 1,000-packet order. Seems at that volume, they're a little over 50 cents a piece for the custom kind. If you wanted to buy in smaller, one-off quantities, they can be purchased as singles, as a 10-pack, as a 100-pack, and so on. Now, the price I told you about is for the custom mix, it appears. They have standard mixes that are a little more inexpensive, and one of them is called the Bee Feed Mix. See Favor. If you bought 1,000 of them, of the made-up packet, the price of this pre-formulated mix is about 30 cents a piece. So they're 20 cents less than the custom one. When you get to that particular offer, you can see what the prices are if you want to order at various quantities. Like I said before, 10, 20, 100, whatever you want, you can order. You can also look at the packaging that's there and a shot of the back of the seed packet, which lists what is in the mix along with planting instructions. So in the bee mix are some that I recognize, even though I'm terrible with plants. Coneflowers, aster, coreopsis, forget-me-nots, and bergamot has a smattering of a few of the handful of seeds that are mixed in the bee mix. Bergamot, planted for the bees and make tea, right? I seem to remember there's a bergamot tea out there. Bentley, by the packaging screenshot, is from Cambridge, New York, in case you were wondering if this was a U.S. seed company and not some seed factory coming out of China. I know that seed packets like this, standard size paper packets of 3 1/4 inch by 4 1/2 inch, are often given out as favors at weddings and such, and it seems this company will cater to any kind of occasion. So I told you about the bee mix, and I'll call it honeybee, but it's probably for pollinators. But they have mixes for this and mixes for that and mixes for weddings and mixes for nonprofits and however, you know, you want to hand them out. They have all kinds of stuff on the website. By the way, I should probably state that I have no affiliation with this company in case there's some troll out there getting ready to accuse me of being a shill for the seed company. I'm just saying because these things happen out there on the interwebs that I get accused of this stuff. So back to Charlie. The link he sent me allows you to send for his free sample packet. I'll have to share some of your personal information because they have to mail it to you, of course. So here's the URL if you want to check that out. It's Bentley, Bentley Seeds, all one word, .com/pages/custom-seed-packets-4. BentleySeeds.com/pages/custom-seeds-packets-4. I just filled out the form, and hopefully a sample is on its way, and I'll remember to tell you what it looks like when it arrives. If you wanted that link and you didn't catch it, you can go to our show notes. Not sure how long it's going to be out there. It looks like it's a promo item. So hopefully you can get in there and get yourself a sample seed packet. It seems that this seed company does a lot of work with charities and such, so hats off to them for their philanthropic efforts, which is what you'll see when you go visit their site. Roundtable number 4, bee-free honey mustard chickpeas. It's been a while since I've shared a recipe on the show. If you didn't pick this out by now, anything that we cover here has to have a beekeeping slant, and in most cases it involves making something with honey. This one happens to be a bonus because the website has the title Bee, B-E-E, Free Honey Mustard. Chickpeas. The funny thing about the source of this recipe is that they refer to it as a honey mustard recipe, but the actual recipe says to use maple syrup, agave syrup, etc., in the ingredients. One demerit for them. I'm simply going to say that if you're making a honey mustard chickpea and you call it bee free, then you should use honey and mustard. Looking past that transgression, here's how you make these. For the ingredients, you'll need 2 cans of chickpeas. Some people call them garbanzo beans. They should be drained, rinsed, and dried. 1/4 cup of your favorite mustard. I think Dijon makes the most sense. 2 tablespoons of honey, or by their recipe, you could use maple syrup, agave syrup, etc. And 1 pinch of coarse sea salt. To make them, preheat your oven 400 degrees. Whisk together your mustard and honey. Prepare your chickpeas by rinse, drain, and drying them. Remove the skins if you want to by rubbing them with a paper towel. Once they're dry, toss them in the dressing and make sure everything is really well coated. If you got a little excess dressing, just remove that by putting them in a strainer. And then evenly distribute them on a lined baking sheet and sprinkle them with the coarse sea salt. Bake them for about 30 to 45 minutes or until crispy. And you should toss them around every once in a while so they get cooked on all sides. Allow them to cool slightly before serving. And then keep them stored in a tightly sealed container. I guess after a while they won't be as crisp, but they'll still be pretty darn good. So there was a note in the recipe about the step to rub the skins off with a paper towel. It's supposed to make it more attractive, but it's an extra step, and from what I've seen, it can be skipped if you don't want to bother. There's a compromise in this that you let them dry really well before you roast them, And if you see any loose skins, just simply pick them off and leave the rest. They'll be fine. I think that's probably the best option so that you don't have those loose skins burning in your oven. If you're not into the honey mustard thing, you could simply toss your chickpeas with a little olive oil and bake them. Then put some seasoning on them as soon as they come out. Do it before you bake and you might end up burning the season, so season them afterwards. Now, of course, there's no honey involved in that option, so I say, what's the fun in that? How about this? Introduce honey with spices instead of mustard, something sweet and savory. Honey and cumin, honey and smoked paprika, honey and rosemary or thyme, or rosemary and thyme. Ooh, honey, cinnamon, nutmeg, chickpeas. I think I have a lot of chickpea snack in my future. Check out the link for the recipe in our show notes. And have fun. Enjoy. Round table number 5. We're on a roll here. Cutout comb frame. Cutout comb frame. Bob Kloss, Jim Schmalz, and I went to the Philadelphia Beekeepers Symposium last weekend. Have a report on that in a moment. But when we got back, Bob showed me a frame that he had in his truck, which he wired for use in an upcoming cutout that he's preparing for. For those uninclined, a cutout is where you take bees out of a structure or a tree or something like that. He and another beekeeper went to check out a hive that has been resident in a barn, and they're going to do the cutout in early spring. And in preparation, he took some time to assemble some frames that are strategically nailed across the face of the frame and along the bottom bar on both sides. One side is permanently wired, and the other has a free wire that can be weaved amongst the nails once the comb is set inside. So he used fishing wire and wired one side, and then he has fishing wire tied around the first nail. And when he sets the comb in, he'll use the fishing wire to string between the nails and hold the comb between the fishing wires on both sides of the frame. I shot a short video of the frame while he was describing its use. You could check that out at our YouTube page for Northwest, youtube.com/NWNJBA. It's a cool idea, and given I'm looking to work with more foundationless as my operation progresses, it would make sense to prep some of these frames in case of broken comb situations in foundationless. You could at least put them back in the hive between these frames. So it's another use for them. So there's a link. Look for NWNJBA video short - cutout comb frame. Round table number 6. It's been a while since we've done any listener feedback. So let me run through a couple of things here. Rich Morris wrote in to let us know he'll be attending the New Jersey Beekeepers Association meeting this weekend. He's bringing the new product that he has to show, the Broodminder Cell, and I'm interested in learning what it is. It's cool that Rich is listening in, and I love his outlook on the Broodminder philosophy, which is citizen science approach. It'll be fun to catch up with him and his cohorts to see where they're taking things in 2017. Guestbook. 2 new entries on the guestbook at our website this week. They happen sporadically. And I wanted to give a shout out to Jamie Privet and his daughter and say thanks to Dave for having the gusto to go back through the catalog of the past shows all the way back to number 1. Very cool. The Sunbright Tennessee Challenge from last episode. So far I didn't get a listener from that hometown to write in, but listener Herschel Cries wrote in to say that his family is from Morgan County, Tennessee, which is the county where Sunbright is, and when he stays there, he stays at the Wiederman Hotel in Deer Lodge, Tennessee, which is about 8 to 10 miles from there as the crow flies, according to Google Maps, and he turns through Sunbright to make his way into the town. So he thought it was pretty neat that we picked that out of the blue to mention in our podcast. From his email, he said, "Small town, but I was not a beekeeper when I was there a couple years ago, so I was not looking for any other beaks. Funny how someone from there is listening. I used to bring back honey from Deer Lodge many years ago." Thanks, Herschel, for checking in and sharing a little bit of home with us. And we got close, but the offer's still out there that if you're from Sunbright, we want to hear from you. For this episode, let's share our new destination, Lincoln, Nebraska. In all of Nebraska, there's only one listener who has checked in on the website. If you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, on the BK Corner homepage, bottom right corner, there's a map that shows where people who are visiting the page are from. So come on, Nebraska, only one person on the map? One person, seriously? We need to get the word out there. I show four visits from an area in the southern part of Lincoln, and according to the map, it's near the Yankee Hills Country Club. So if you are a beekeeper from Lincoln, please write me an email to say hello. Kevin@bkcorner.org is my email address, and let's see if we can connect. Just tell me who you are, what you do, what kind of beekeeping you got going on there. And like I said when I started this, first one to write in from that location will get a little something in return for taking the time to say howdy. Want to give a shout out to Marcus Sorensen, who is a listener from Australia. He wrote in to say, "Love your podcast. Beekeeping in Australia is a bit different here. Only run one brood box. Flow most of the year around. No varroa mite for now. I have Caucasian bees because they seem to be the best at management of small hive beetle. I don't seem to have any drama with them. They are super quiet and extremely productive in these conditions." Yeah, neat. Caucasian bees. First person I know who said they have Caucasians. Bob Kloss and I were talking about getting some Russians, but how cool would it be to have some Caucasians in play, too? Marcus also asked if it would be possible for us to share the hive inspection sheet that we made. He wanted a version that he could edit. I sent him the latest one that I had revised sometime in September in Word format. I guess this should take a few minutes to replace the one on our homepage with the most up-to-date one from my local knowledge base that I keep. So thanks, Marcus, for taking the time to write in, and sorry it took a bit to get back to you. Let me know how you make out with that form. Two more quick listener-related notes. First, I haven't asked for this in a while, but if you have a moment, and you wouldn't mind, if you're an Apple user, I have a favor to ask. Would you please consider leaving a review of our podcast in the iTunes store? It helps the show there if there are reviews. And let me be clear, pro or con, I'm okay with positive or constructive comments. In addition, Android users can leave a comment for us in the Play Store. You know, a lot of effort goes into the show, and I'm not doing it for money, so my payment is being able to reach as wide as an audience as possible with the effort. Go through all this work, I'm hoping a lot of people are listening. So thanks in advance for any of you that helped me out with this. The second note is thanks to anyone who donates to the show. I pay for all the expenses out of pocket for the web hosting, equipment to produce the show and such, and a donation here or there helps to defray the cost and is always appreciated. This episode, I simply wanted to say thanks to Lauren and Steven for supporting the effort. Roundtable number 7, the Philly recap. Last weekend, we went to the Philly Symposium. As I said, we were going to head down. I had prepped all the content for this episode and expected that I would come back in a future episode and cover what was covered. But I have to say now, I'm going to tell you a smidge because it was amazing. Amazing. All of the speakers were just rock solid. First up was the PA state apiarist, Karen Rakaseka. She spoke last year. She just kind of went over some generalities. But this year, multiple things that she said were pretty insightful and interesting. as to what's going on in Pennsylvania. The one that piqued my interest the most was the follow-up to the antibiotics law that went into place here in January. There are people processing this thing in real time, and it seems, as she stated, that there are new understandings about how it's going to go down. And discussions are forming and evolving as we speak. I think everybody had a notion, but now that they have to deal with it, they're getting to the mechanics of how to handle it, and it's completely changed the way that they're looking at things. At one point, she made to illustrate in the thread of discussion is that antibiotics are now regulated by the government, who wishes to keep the antibiotics out of our food that we consume. But in a practical matter, one of those mechanic things, how it's applied impacts our ability to use them as beekeepers. And this is how we fall under scrutiny. So as an example, things that we give the bees and how they are introduced to the bees are different than what you do for livestock, cows, chickens, and so on. And it matters. The mechanism in which it's applied as food fed to them or applied topically through sprinkling is important, as it makes the distinction as to whether it's a prescription or if it's a veterinary feed. My takeaway is feeds are regulated differently than prescriptions provided by a vet. As beekeepers, how are we to know the ins and outs of this thing? And, well, you know what? Time's running out. Spring is coming. These laws went into effect in January, and the beekeeping season is fast approaching. So who's to say what instructions there will be for us, the beekeepers, if we find ourselves in the need of these antibiotics? Now, typically, antibiotics are not a big deal because we don't use a ton of them in beekeeping. But if we do need them, how are we supposed to handle it? So Bob, Jim, and I were talking about this, and perhaps I can see if I can chat with Tim Schuler this weekend, New Jersey's state apiarist, and ask him to come in and talk about how New Jersey is doing at providing guidance on the topic. I suspect, and it was assured, that instructions are becoming will be coming out in PA and other areas as this works through the industry, and I'm sure more will become as people start to wrestle with the fact that people want answers on this. One thing's for sure, in the questions back to the apiarist from the audience, someone asked if they had a problem, should they be expected to take their frame to the vet for diagnosis? Folks, the answer to that is flat out no. Do not, under any circumstance, take a frame that could be infected from your apiary to any other place to get a review. No, no, no. Please call someone in to make the diagnosis for you if you can't figure out yourself. There's plenty of guides out there to tell you how to inspect for diseases. It's something that with just a smidge of research you could figure out yourself. But if you don't know, call somebody in. Don't take your stuff out to the world. So mostly we're talking about American Foul Brood or AFB. That's the big one we're concerned about. And if you really can't figure out how to test it for yourself, you could consider buying a test kit from a beekeeping supplier if you're so inclined. Check Man Lake, ship it to your home, and after 3.5 minutes, you'll know if you have AFB after running the test. The speaker after the state apiarist was Rebecca Masterman from University of Minnesota. Wow, talk about industrious. These people are on a roll. I remember first learning of the UOM Bee Squad at a beekeeping conference, and I didn't quite get it back then. It seemed kind of odd what they were trying to do. Now seeing what the program has evolved to, well, kudos for them. They are doing an incredible amount of things at beekeeping in Minnesota, and I'm jealous and wish we had something like that in New Jersey. Are you listening, Rutgers, or anybody else here? I have to talk to our friend Mr. Gilly and see if we can have him take a peek at what Minnesota is doing. So I asked Rebecca for contact information and made preliminary arrangements to have her on the show and tell us directly all that they have going on, because it would take a full episode to explain their different programs. Megan Milbrath, She had me at a low. It's kind of funny. I've never met or heard of Megan before Philly, but I gather that she's been out there and around and people know who she is. I know that's odd to some, as she's been out and about, and I probably ran across her at EAS this past year, but didn't make the connection. She's being published in American Bee Journal or whatever, I'm sure. So the reason she had me at hello is her talk was about toward treatment free. And I would love to be treatment free. Simply, flat out, no treatments. But alas, I have not been able to find my way there yet, and she articulated what I've failed to be able to put together and describe on this show, although I've circled around it a good number of times, that why treatment-free is simply not stopping to treat. It's not going to work. She, in the most insightful way, led us through the treatment-free patterns that people take and the factors that make it difficult, if not impossible, for some to achieve. She acknowledged that there's pockets of the world out there that will find success with this, but for many it will be an exercise in frustration and for some, flat-out animal cruelty. Her breakdown on why some of these approaches don't work and how to change up the program to get them to work, no matter where you are, with smart and common sense and, well, I think sustainable. I've struggled to find a balance with this treatment-free thing, and with Megan's way, I think I've seen the light. I've said on a number of occasions that something about the place where I keep bees here in New Jersey has prevented some of the treatment-free approaches from working, and I have tried them. But I've been somewhat castigated as a shill for the chemical companies because I'm saying they don't work for me and people don't believe that. But the simple fact is, and I already know, if I don't treat my bees, they're going to die. And I'm not for letting them die. I wouldn't let my dog die out in the yard. You know, I'm just not doing that type of thing. So I've struggled to reconcile that personally, and while I'm not seeking an end-all answer is an excuse, I would say that what Megan laid out is a pretty sound argument that can be applied to the model of beekeeping in my region, and it connects the dots. At the core of her hypothesis is the impact of the varroa mite, and specifically the drift that's being observed. And the gather that I got is there's a new theme that varroa is not about the hive, it's about the ecosystem of apiaries in contact with each other. At one point, one of the speakers brought up a map and showed apiaries all over and said, if these apiaries are in contact with each other, meaning the bees are within flying distance of the other, they're all one big apiary. And I've always believed that, and that's a really important notion in this. So the takeaway here is when colonies are dying, mites seem to be able to sense this and are hitching a ride out of the sinking ship. And if you're in an area with a density of beekeepers, your neighbors that are within flying distance are literally part of your apiary. So like Rebecca, I have Megan's contact information and made the connection to bring her on the show. Not to be outdone, there were two more stellar speakers. I love when people talk about things that I have not explored in depth. And Deb Delaney did just that, talking about nutrition source and how plants interact with insects. I've heard this topic here and there, but she did a really good job at covering some details about plant design and what they do to entice, dissuade, and basically exploit any means to survive as it relates to their interaction with insects for plant sex. Yes, I said plant sex. Who knew? Insects and flowers could be sexy. Okay, look, I'm not going to go down that route. I'm trying to be brief and I'm out of time. So I'll come back to this again in the future and talk a little bit more about how she laid it out and some of the things that she said that were new. Hadn't explored that, so it's pretty cool. Last but certainly not least was Mr. Samuel Ramsey. I love it when something you know is blown up. In this case of Samuel, he stepped us through the debunking of what varroa do when feeding on a bee. In all the years of being a beekeeper, I've been told and have repeated even on this show that varroa feed on the hemolymph of a bee. Hemolymph is akin to the circulatory system, or better said, blood of the insect, if you're not familiar with what that is. Do they feed on the blood of a bee? Are varroas the blood-sucking vampires we think they are? No. It turns out they're feeding on the vitellogenin-rich fat sources and fat stores that line the bee's body and especially collect on the underside of a bee. And he walked us through how it gets there and why it's important and what about the vitellogenin is the catalyst for the varroa to get to it. Damn, that's as cool as plant sex. The information's been making the rounds, but to hear it from Sam directly was cool. As one of Dennis Van Engelsdorp's grad students, Sam told us of the journey of the trial and error, discovery and enlightenment, and the ways that they solved the puzzle that led to the aha moments. And let me tell you, folks, some of the things they did, as a general person, you would go, nobody would ever take this approach. And that was really cool, is nobody gave them the boundaries. They created artificial, with using pills and some sort of a membrane, they created artificial bees for the varroa to feed on. I mean, what he explained is just, nobody would ever do that, but they did it. It was pretty cool. Gotta love grad students. I love this notion, and it goes a long way to explaining, which he covered in his talk, why feeding bees something that could get in their hemolymph would not work, something that I know scientists have been meandering in and out of for years. Again, I have Sam's contact information and a lot of work to do to circle back. I said that one of my 2017 focuses is to get zen with bringing folks like this to the program, and I'll be reaching out and following up and bring you interviews with these people in the coming weeks if they'll have me. I would love to have them on the show to tell the story instead of me summarizing their topics for you. So if I can make these connections, I might hold off until I get them here. It will be so much richer that way. One way or the other, though, I'll tell you what they said. So Philly Symposium, check. Amazing this year. I'm pretty sure it was the best beekeeping event that I've ever been to. Period. Just an amazing investment in one day. And if you're not going to some of these shows, you really should think about that. So given that, I'm going to spend today and tomorrow with James Tu and some others at this weekend's NJBA meeting. I'm hoping it will be as successful as an investment. Okay, I'm to the bottom of the stack. Let's go ahead and wrap up and go to a couple closing comments. I wanted to share a funny moment to close the show. I was standing in line for coffee in Philly and talking with Jim Schmalz when I heard a voice behind me say, "Hey, Kevin, I didn't recognize you, but when I heard your voice, I knew it was you." It's always kind of funny to be recognized in that way. The voice on the other side to reciprocate was Merle Stone from Fairwinds Farm Apiary, and Merle happens to be the president of the Chester County Beekeepers Association. We started talking, and I let him know we were planning to join them for the talk on March 11th. Dewey Caron is a featured speaker there, and Merle gave me a business card and is going to speak with Dewey to see if we can get an interview for the show while we are there for the day. So yes, it continues to remind that it was a good day all around in Philly. Oh my, look at the time. I really thought I'd be disciplined this year and keep episodes to 1 hour duration. And I'm 1 for 3 so far. I see that I'm going to have to tweak and call it 1 hour and 15 minutes. That seems more practical to the running time and to accommodate my gift of gab. So one other thing to quickly cover. Jim, Bob, and I have been working on the bee cage for Northwest. We've got the sides all done, glued them all together, And we're at the point now where we're going to put the plexiglass, put in the screening, and then we have to get to building the roof. It's funny that I thought it would be a little easier, but the fact of the matter is it's a boutique process, and we're literally building each thing by looking at a photograph. And when you don't have plans, you just kind of have to play it by ear. And the three of us tend to be rather meticulous. So we're being very careful about the measurements and the way it looks and how it's coming out. Made a couple mistakes here and there, but we didn't want to spend a lot of the association's money. So we've been very careful at trying not to create waste wood by cutting wrong. So measure twice, cut once has been our mantra. So far, really happy with the effort. One of the things we were trying to solve is the puzzle of how to lock everything together. How to set the sides down on the floor and secure them. Make them easy so that everybody can do it. But also keep the panels lightweight and make sure that they're not going to get broken when they get tossed in the truck or stacked or stashed or whatever. So it's been a mind-brain exercise to go over every single piece, and as you might imagine, I've been taking photos all the way through in order to make an expose on this and hope someday to be published in one of the journals with it. So it's been a lot of fun. Really enjoyed putting this together. I'd like to see the project through so that I can get to my projects at home. It's kind of funny when you have so many things to do at home and you go and work on something like this for the association, but fact of the matter is, for years to come, that will be used and enjoyed and appreciated and provide a capability for the Northwest crew of public outreach that is immeasurable. So it's well worth the effort. And I like having a hand at building something that becomes something. It's always been my mantra in life that you should build things, folks. It really gives you a sense of accomplishment. So I'll end this with, have any comments? Just to say hi, tell me how you're doing, how your bees are making out. Ask me anything you want. Send me a note, kevin@bkcorner.org, our website, www.bkcorner.org. Because I've been working so much, I haven't had a chance to publish some of those things that I wanted to do, but work, especially this one terrible, awful project we're on is coming to a close. We finally cleared UAT yesterday. That's user acceptance testing for the uninclined. And I would be so happy to have my life back after this thing. So, you know, there's times when I'd really like to enjoy my nights and do things on writing about beekeeping and so on. And it looks like we're going to afford some opportunity to do that in the near future. And I have so many things that I'd like to get to. And my wife thinks I'm crazy, but this is my passion, so I really enjoy it. And I have a couple videos to produce. If you've never seen, youtube.com/NWNJBA. Tons of videos out there, and we'll continue to produce more this year. I have a bunch of different ideas, including that cutout that I was talking about for Bob Kloss. We're going to go over and film that. I'm going to kind of try and step back from that and not be an active participant. There seems there's a couple beekeepers involved with it, so I can do documentary mode. And I think that's going to be a cool one. The last thing that I wanted to say is Bob and I were talking about, and I didn't want to forget to mention this on the podcast, one of the more popular videos up there on the channel is a extraction that he tried to do out of a tree where he set up a hive on the outside of a tree, and as the bees passed, it prevented them from going back in. It didn't work as intended, and over time, Bob and I always revisit that and try to figure out. Well, one of the things he saw or learned is that you cut a hole in the other side of the tree, and you smoke the inside of the chamber to force the colony out. And I said to Bob, that was interesting. You could fill the chamber with water or do other things, too, we were hypothesizing. And we're now starting to think about how you would approach that thing all over again. So it was a lot of fun to have that little exercise. All right. Time to close it down. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with whatever we have produced. Not sure what it's going to be. And I'll leave you with this. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.